The Hurtwood Federation, our industry's advocacy voice on Capitol Hill, represents thousands of hardwood businesses in every state of the U.S. where hardwoods grow, as well as the majority of trade associations engaged in manufacturing, wholesaling, or distribution of American hardwood lumber, veneer, plywood, flooring, and related products. Their work is far from dull, and as you can imagine, these days, it's even more interesting. Hardwood Federation Executive Director Dana Lee Cole is with us today to provide an update on the happenings in our nation's capital and to shed light on how hardwood industry issues may be impacted by the new administration. Her presentation is entitled Politics and Policy in the Trumped Up World of D.C. Sounds very interesting. Let's welcome Dana Lee Cole.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be here today. I cannot take credit for that title. That's all Linda. So thank you, Linda, for making me sound interesting and encouraging people to attend. Just to be sure. Okay. So, again, it's a pleasure to be here today. It's great to be out of Washington, D.C., although it seems to keep running with or without me in the city. For those of you that may not have met me before or seen me before, it's hard to imagine, but I know Linda always pulls in new people here to this meeting. The Hardwood Federation is exactly that. We're a federation of trade associations, 27 trade associations that have something to do with the hardwood industry. HMA is one of our founding members, and it's always a pleasure to see everyone and to thank them for their participation because it's really been invaluable to our efforts. Our main goal is to educate Congress and the administration about the hardwood industry, what it brings to the economy, what issues impact you, how federal policy could help or hinder your efforts to keep your businesses growing and vibrant. So we talked to a lot of people up on Capitol Hill. We talked to people of the administration. As you can imagine, it's been a lot of introducing ourselves around town these days, so that keeps us busy. But our members are also extremely helpful. We've got a lot of folks that know members of Congress just from being involved either in politics or just knowing them growing up. We've got a lot of folks that actually have good ties with the administration right now, so we are working particularly hard to establish ties through those ties, kind of using our connections. One of the things that we do every year with the Hardwood Federation is we bring a group of industry executives to Washington, D.C. to do what we call our fly-in. That means you as industry executives fly into Washington, D.C. We organized a number of meetings up on Capitol Hill. In the past few years, it's been 100 plus, 120, 130 meetings up on Capitol Hill. You as an individual, if you participate, don't do 100 meetings, but we select some specific members of Congress for you to meet with that either represent you and your businesses or maybe are from states where you have a business presence. And we talk about our issues. And this year, those dates are September 12th through the 13th. I think with the new administration, I'm hoping with the new administration that a lot of people will be really interested and come to Washington. So look in the next few weeks. We'll be getting out our registration information. Linda will be getting it. Anybody on my mailing list will be getting it, and hopefully folks will share that information. And if you've been to the fly-in before, please encourage other folks to come because it really is a great experience, I think, and it really is enlightening for people to see how members of Congress kind of conduct themselves in their offices and how their staff work. And I have to say, I've been in Washington for now almost 15 years, 5 years with the Federation, and there is definitely a palpable energy and excitement up on Capitol Hill these days. Sometimes it's panic, sometimes it's excitement, sometimes it's just an energy up there that I haven't seen in a while. So it's really a good time to be up there and contribute to this energy. And people are really interested to know what's going on and seem to be really taking in from members of the public. So if you're interested in all in politics, if you've been following things and want to have a little bit of input, please think about coming to Washington, D.C. The other thing that we do during our fly-in is we do a couple of receptions with members of Congress, and we acknowledge them with PAC checks. The Federation does have a PAC. We raise money every year to support those members of Congress that support us in our initiatives. We don't just give to somebody's friend just because they happen to go to college with them or were their roommate. But we do really look at their voting record. We look at what they've done for us. We look at how they talk about the industry, and we reward them, because the more friends we have on Capitol Hill, the easier it is for us to get things done. So that is the Federation, and I'll be around the rest of today and at the reception. I'll be collecting PAC donations tonight, or if you would like to contribute to our corporate fund, we value that contribution and that support as well, because we can't do our jobs if we don't have those funds. But stop by and see me, and if you've got questions, I'd be happy to answer them. So I'm going to talk very briefly about 2016, because, be honest with you, 2016 seems so long ago to me. You know, I know it's only the end of March, but 2016 just feels like it was like 2 years ago or 3 years ago. But we actually did a lot in 2016. We made some strides on some issues that are very important to the industry. The northern long-eared bat has been an issue for us for the past few years, and it was finally declared a threatened species, not an endangered species, so that was a huge victory for us. And a 4D plan was put into effect that manages how the bat should be protected. And there were a lot of benefits for the forest products industry. There were a lot of concessions made to us in that 4D rule. And of course, as soon as all of this came out, and we were very happy with it, a couple of environmental groups sued to have this 4D rule stopped and to have the bat declared as threatened. So we're currently engaged in some legal activities to actually support the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision on the northern long-eared bat. This is a long process. We've been at this for, I think, 6 or 7 months already, and they still haven't scheduled any kind of hearing, so I don't think anything will happen to the end of the year. But we are engaged in this. We're working with a coalition of groups that have funded the legal support team, and we're keeping our eye very close on this, because it can be important, and we really want this rule to stand, because it will inform the decisions that are made about some other bats that are most likely going to come up for consideration in the next couple of years. Federal forest reform, again, another long-term issue that we've been dealing with. We really need to get how our forests are managed under control. We need to fight wildfires. We don't just need to fight wildfires, but we need to prevent them. And one of the tools to use to prevent forest fires in our national forests is to actually maybe take some timber off and to thin out those forests and to get some mills back working. So this is an issue that we've been working on for a long time. We came very close at the end of the year to having some new rules implemented and some new capacity for that. Unfortunately, it didn't make the year-end omnibus bill. But, you know, politics is kind of a game of inches and not of yards. And what we were able to accomplish last year was we were able to get some folks on our side talking about forest management in a supportive way that never would have talked that way about it 2 or 3 years ago. Specifically, there were some Democratic senators that are now really working with us to craft legislation that can actually be implemented. And that's huge, because we do, you know, we have a lot of Republicans that are, they understand it, they get it, they're from states that have a lot of forests and forest products industry, and some of the Democrats that maybe should understand those issues aren't always so willing to work with us. But more and more are, and I think a lot of that is actually because there's been so many fires and so much wood has been burned up. And would they rather see the wood burned up, or would they rather see it made into a beautiful table and trees replanted? It's becoming a choice that's much more clear for them. So we've moved the ball on this, and I think there's actually some hope for further progress this year and next year, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. Biomass is a carbon-neutral source of energy. Again, very much the same as federal forest management. Came close last year, didn't quite make it. Back up this year with additional support, and I'm hopeful that with the new structure at EPA, we might even make more strides to have EPA formally recognize carbon biomass as a carbon-neutral source of energy. The estate and gift tax, this was a big one, and it might have been something that kind of flew under your radar because it didn't happen until the end of last year. Late August, on a Friday afternoon, the IRS came out with a proposed rule that would have essentially created a 30% increase on the estate tax. It was very quietly done. It took people a couple weeks to even figure it out. But as soon as we did, and as soon as a lot of small groups with small business interests figured it out, we all kind of got together and generated comments and commented ourselves and raised a ruckus up on the Hill. And over 10,000 comments were generated to the IRS. So what essentially happened was there were so many comments, and the IRS was required to respond to every comment that's made. They couldn't do it, so they ran out of time to implement the rule. according to kind of the process that is set before them. So they kind of, it was right when President Trump was taking office, they said, okay, we can't implement this rule. We don't have enough time. So we're just going to put it on the shelf, which is very good because now it's on the shelf. It's been rescinded, or it's not been rescinded. We now want it to be formally rescinded, and we're working with Congress to do that. But this is one of those times where, you know, they tried to sneak something through. People were alert, and somebody was paying attention, and we were able to generate enough noise to have it pulled back. And now hopefully, I'm very positive that we'll be able to have it formally rescinded so it can't come back to haunt us sometime in the future. So that was a big win. We also worked a lot on truck weights. We really haven't made much progress. I'm not really sure what's going to happen with all the infrastructure discussions and talk this year, but you know, it's on our radar, and we continue to monitor it. It's just going to be a really tough battle to ever increase those truck weights. But we're continuing to track that. So that was 2016, and then we had an election at the end, and we had some very interesting election results. You know, I'm sure everybody in this room is kind of following the politics. You couldn't help but followed the election last year. You really couldn't escape it, ever. And, you know, despite a lot of predictions that were made, Donald Trump became president in January, but was elected president in November. So Republican White House. In the U.S. Senate, there was a lot of talk that Republicans would lose a lot of seats and lose the majority. They lost two seats, but they retained the majority 52-48. So that was a surprise. In the U.S. House, a lot of pollsters were predicting 30 seats would be lost. They didn't lose that many. They only lost 7 or 8 seats. So they retained a majority, 237 to 193. It's smaller. And it's interesting, you know, when you go up and you talk to staff up there, and you're like, how is it? They kind of say it hasn't really changed much. Because we still have to get Democratic votes in the Senate to pass anything, to get it to the president's desk. That's changed. The possibility that Republican-backed bills will be signed into law, that's changed a lot, you know. But actually getting those bills to the president's desk, that's still about the same in terms of difficulty. Maybe a little bit more difficult because they lost those two seats in the Senate. What's really interesting is if you start to look beyond the national results, the federal seats that were up, in terms of U.S. governors, we now have 33 Republican governors, 16 Democrats, and 1 independent, that's a lot of Republican governors. When I worked for a Republican governor back in my youth, it was kind of opposite. So things change, but right now the change has been very significantly towards the Republicans at kind of the second tier of the elective politics in the United States. And if you go another layer down and you start looking at state legislatures, you've got 67 chambers that are now Republican, and you've got 31 Democrat. That's a huge majority in terms of the Republicans. So what you've seen over the last few years is kind of a turn not only at the federal level, but also at the state and local level, going a little bit more Republican. So I'm going to show you a few maps that are fascinating to look at. So this is the governors by party. Obviously, the red is Republicans, the blue is the Democrats. Alaska is the independent there in yellow. But you can see it's probably pretty much what people would think this map would look like in terms of governors. And then if you look at the state legislatures by party, you see, again, huge swaths in the middle of the country are red. You've got the blue states. And this is where both chambers would be Republican or Democratic. And then the pink, or it's not really pink here, it's more of the purple. Those are split legislatures where you might have a House that's Republican and a Senate that's Democrat. So again, it's a very fascinating map. And then this is red America, and this is probably not showing up great here. But this is where you have states with a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. So, you know, kind of what you would think. And then these are the split states, the dark states, or the split states. And then these are the Democratic states. And I think even in the back, you can see that there's 5 of them that have a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature, and they're on the coasts. Now, I don't want anybody that's a Republican in here to say, happy days are here forever. And I don't want Democrats in the room to say, oh my God, the world is ending. because this can change in a heartbeat. But I think it's really interesting to just look at kind of how the Democrat or the demographics are shaking out in the country right now and kind of where popular thought might be as we look at the federal policy agenda and what could or could not happen in the next couple of years. So now let's turn a little bit to the Trump priorities, at least as we're kind of reading them right now, and this is probably not a surprise to anybody. Tax reform, regulatory reform, infrastructure and trade. This is in no particular order. I don't want anyone to think that this is my list of what I think is important, but it's what the president talked about on the campaign trail. It's what he's pursuing now as the president, and it's what's being talked about up on the Hill. You could probably also put up here the Supreme Court. Of course, that's taking up a lot of time these days. So that's another priority, but I don't think it's necessarily one of his priorities, his policy priorities. It's more of a governing priority for him. So these are the priorities. You know, tax reform, he's looking for more fair corporate taxes. Regulatory reform, he's looking to lower the burden on companies in terms of what they have to report to the federal government. Infrastructure, you know, he's talked a lot about the need to invest money in our roads and in our railroads and in our airports, and I'm hoping he will do something about the electric grid as well. That would be good. Again, all of these things kind of either cost money or would reduce the budget, so these are controversial and hard to do. These aren't easy things to do. And then the last thing on there is trade, which is an issue that the Federation hasn't really paid attention to, but it hasn't been something we've been terribly involved in. But some of the rhetoric coming out of the campaign and some of the actions since the inauguration have increased our interest dramatically, and we are taking a lot of action there. So I'll talk about that in some detail in just a minute. And then here's our priorities, which should look pretty familiar to everybody here that's heard me before. Federal forest management, tax and regulatory reform. The Farm Bill will be coming up for expiration next year, so we're already working on getting some of our programs of interest into the Farm Bill. Biomass, carbon neutrality, and then trade has been added to our list of top priorities. So I want to talk a little bit about the Farm Bill and what our interests are here. Number one, hardwood export funding. Mike Snow was here this morning. He talked about all the great work he's doing. He gets a significant part of his money and his support from the federal government, from a couple of programs that support export promotion in different industries. I think hardwood is the second or third highest level of funding from the federal government, and he does a great job with every penny he gets. But we've got to be really careful and make sure that that funding stays in the Farm Bill at the level or greater level than it already is. And we also have to work really hard to make sure that hardwood is continue to be recognized as a program deserving of those funds. So this is probably our number one goal here with the Farm Bill, is to make sure that that funding stays in. Dina Lanko from Appalachian Wood Products a few weeks ago came up to Washington, D.C. and testified before a House subcommittee in charge of the AHEC program and the funding levels, and he did a great job. He was the only non-food commodity represented on the panel, and he made a point of that, and he said, don't forget about the trees, because exporting of our lumber and our lumber products is really important, and it made an impression on the subcommittee. So that was great, and we'll continue to work through those members and then through the House and Senate committees on these funding needs as we go forward. Forest management measures. This is also going to be a great vehicle to get federal forest management moved forward. 5 years ago, there were some exclusions included in the Farm Bill. We're hoping that more will be included in the 2018 version, and we're looking for other ways that we can add federal forest management provisions into that bill that will help, you know, increase some of these timber harvest goals, get some activity on there, loosen up a little bit on the regulatory burden and the legal challenges that come up when these timber sales go on auction. So there's a lot of potential here for moving things through the Farm Bill. Energy programs are another area that we have an opportunity to get some things in there that would support our industry. One of the things that we hear a lot about recently is that there are a lot of residuals building up on on properties, on mill properties, the sawdust and the bark, because nobody's taking it right now. So we're looking at some energy programs which would support the pellet industry and support tax incentives to get wood-burning energy sources into homes and into other facilities. So these are the kinds of programs that we're also looking to include in the Farm Bill. Some of them are already there, but we're looking to enhance them and to make sure that that wood products and biomass are included in those programs. We're doing this individually. We're going up and meeting with members of Congress, but we're also involved in a fairly broad coalition on these issues. So I think we will be very well keyed in, and this will definitely be something that we'll be talking about at the fly-in in September. Regulatory reform. This is another area where I think, you know, this is one of those things I'm not sure people are really paying attention to, because there's a lot of noise coming out of the White House and out of Congress right now that's blocking out some of the actual things that are getting done. You know, one of the criticisms of Washington has always been, well, nothing ever gets done. Nothing ever passes. Nothing ever gets signed. In regulatory reform, some things are actually getting done. The House has a couple of bills that they introduced really quickly in early February. H.R. 5, which would require the least costly alternatives when considering rules. There's a companion bill in the Senate. There's a lot of interest in this and a lot of activity around this bill. And H.R. 26, which says that Congress must approve over rules that would cost the U.S. economy over $100 million. Which is another important thing, because so many times rules have been implemented with no cost, with no consideration of the cost on businesses or on the U.S. economy. Again, there's a companion bill in the Senate, a lot of energy around this. And the other thing that there's been a lot of energy around is the use of the Congressional Review Act, which basically says that you can repeal rules that were put into place 60 days prior to Congress coming into session. So that means kind of the last 2.5 months of the Obama administration, any rules that were put into place can be rescinded with a strict majority. So in the Senate's case, you would need 51 votes. This has been used to surprisingly good effect over the last couple of months. Five rules have passed the House and the Senate. Three have been signed by the president. Two more are on his desk right now. And it might not sound like a lot, but this rule has been used only once in the last 30 years. So the Republicans really took a hold of this and said, we're going to make some good use of this. And they pulled back some rules that are pretty interesting. There was a Dodd-Frank financial rule requiring publicly traded oil and gas companies to disclose payments to governments. They've rescinded that rule. There was a Steam Protection Act, which was some restrictions on coal mines. They pulled that back. A repeal of a rule requiring the Social Security Administration to share information about individuals who don't manage their own funds. They've taken away that rule. And today, this morning, the Senate sent a rule over to the president for signature, and every indication is that he will sign it, that will have a definite impact on our industry, which is that OSHA cannot require companies to keep records of illnesses, injuries, or health situations for 5 years. OSHA had put this rule into place at the very end of the Obama administration and said, we now, instead of requiring 6 months of records, we want 5 years. So that rule will be repealed. And it had lost a couple of times in court, but the administration went through and implemented the rule anyway. But I think this is something that definitely impacts our industry because it was for companies of 10 or more employees. So they are, and there's one more on federal contract bidding and releasing information from a company that's also been rescinded. So they are making good use of this, and I think there'll be several more rules pulled back in the next few months. The other thing that's happening a lot in terms of regulatory reform is executive orders. And I got to be honest with you, executive orders a lot of times don't mean a whole lot. Because executive orders say, I'm making an executive order to review and report back to the president. But sometimes those are good things. Some of the executive orders the president has signed include kind of the two-for-one executive order, which says to state or to federal agencies and departments, for every rule that you implement, you'd have to take two away. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether this can really happen, how you really do this, what the costs are assigned. But what the good part of that rule is that it's really starting to make people think a little bit before they start designing new rules and kind of saying, okay, well, we have this rule that we'd like to implement, but really what can we take away? And do we really need to implement this rule, and are there other ways to do it? So I think it's kind of put a bit of a pause on some things that were in the pipeline that are now kind of not moving forward so quickly. The regulatory reform agenda, again, which was signed as an EO, is a way to create task forces within each agency that kind of review regulatory rules and policies. And again, this is a good thing to require each State Department and each agency to look at the rules that they currently have on the books and to figure out if there are old ones. I mean, we all know that there are rules and laws that have been on the books forever and ever and ever, and nobody really pays attention to them, or they're really out of date because they don't deal with technology, or they don't acknowledge technology, or they don't acknowledge how the world has changed. And those just need to be cleared up. So hopefully this will generate some clearing out of these rules and regulations that have just been piling up over the years. He's also on schedule to sign an executive order repealing the Clean Power Plan, which would have put a lot of burdens on states to do regulatory work on air emissions. A lot of it, if you listen to opponents of that rule, they said that, you know, the technology doesn't even exist to get to the levels that the Clean Power Plan was proposing. So this, I think, is a way to kind of clear the decks on that and take another look at how the Clean Air Act is implemented and how states' air departments are required to adhere to those rules. So there's a lot going on in this area. A lot's actually happening. I think more will happen, and I think if you look at some of the new department secretaries, they're very serious about this. Scott Pruitt has said he's the new head of the EPA. A lot of people are very concerned about what he's going to do because they think he's going to turn the clock back on regulatory exercises, you know, and the water's going to get dirtier and the air is going to get dirtier. But I think if what you look at what he says and how he's been talking to his staff and how he's been talking to the press, what he says is, listen, we're going to implement the laws the way Congress passed them. We're not, as an agency, going to start writing rules that circumvent the congressional process, because that's what EPA has been doing for years, because they couldn't get anything through Congress. So they would just write rules, put them out there, do the whole comment collection thing, and then push these rules through without any kind of oversight from those that we elect to give that oversight. So I think that could be a good thing, and again, will reduce the burden on regulations to us. So then finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about trade. This has been a big issue, and, you know, all of a sudden, after the inauguration, I started to get phone calls from some folks that were very, very concerned about trade and where we were going and where the president was going. There was a lot of rhetoric during the campaign about putting 35 or 45% tariffs on China. There was a lot of talk about getting tough with our trading partners. There was a lot of talk about pulling out of trade agreements. So people were a little bit nervous once the president took office about what was really going to happen. The fear on the tariffs is that if you start throwing 35% blanket tariffs on China, there's going to be retaliatory action. And so much of our product is being exported to China right now, and so many companies depend on that. What's that going to do to our companies? But then on the other side, there was talk that, well, you know, we're in the panel business, and we face a lot of pressure from subsidized panels that are coming over for China, so something needs to be done with that. So we've gotten really involved in this. We've been working really hard to make some connections. We've been trying to figure out who's in power, who's got the president's ear, and what they're all really saying, because there's a lot of noise out there, again, about these kinds of things. So these are the trade players. These are the people that are going to be making the decisions on trade. Or not making the decisions, but having an influence on how those decisions are made. First is Peter Navarro, who's probably the hardest line on China and on trade in general. He's authored a book called Death by China. I'm sure many of you have heard about that. And, you know, he believes that there's a deep imbalance between the U.S. and China, and that a really hard line needs to be drawn, and that taking strong and decisive action would benefit the U.S. in the long run. The Robert Lighthizer Lighthizer, who has been nominated to be the U.S. Trade Representative. He will stay tough on China. He's been tough on Japan in the past, but he's not so much for kind of just all of a sudden dumping a tariff on a country. He's more of a stick and carrot kind of a guy. So he'll be like, we need to talk about this or we're going to have to take some strong action. And he's been able in his past life as an assistant U.S. trade representative to actually move and have some good success with Japan on steel. And there was steel and one other product. I think it was some clothing also that he worked on. But he was able to do some really good things there. Wilbur Ross, who's been named and confirmed as the Commerce Secretary, has a lot of experience with trade, importing, exporting. He's probably going to be the key player. We've had some conversations with some folks in the White House that are assisting in these discussions, and Wilbur Ross's name comes up a lot as somebody that's going to be a very big player. He has written some articles with Peter Navarro promoting lower taxes and fewer regulations, as well as tough trade policies. But he's also advocated for tariffs as a tool, but not necessarily the answer. And during his confirmation hearings, he said that he is not anti-trade. He is pro-trade and is going to support our ability to trade internationally. But he understands that industries face unfair competition, and he wants to deal with it. So he's going to be very important in these discussions. Terry Branstad, who has been named as the ambassador to China, although not confirmed yet, he is also going to be tremendously important as we discuss with China how we're going to handle trade policy going forward. Governor Branstad has a long relationship with China. He actually, his family actually hosted the premier of China when he was an exchange student in Iowa. The Chinese value relationships, they value long-time relationships. I think from what we've heard that when he was named as the ambassador to China, there was actually kind of a sigh of relief from the Chinese because they feel like he is somebody that they can communicate with and that they can work with. So I think he will be a very strong advocate for keeping those trading partnerships open and flexible. He comes from Iowa. He understands the agricultural sector. So I think he's going to also be an ally in terms of making sure that we keep our markets open, but that where we're facing unfair competition, that we address that. Sonny Perdue, who is, as we speak, I believe, in front of a confirmation panel in the Senate Agriculture Committee, former governor of Georgia, he will be hopefully the USDA secretary, the agricultural secretary. Again, longtime friend of the industry, understands the forestry industry. I talked to some folks that know him well last night, and they said he understands trees. He also understands some chickens, and he understands some beans and some corn. So he's going to be very much somebody that understands that we have markets that we need to protect and we want to keep exporting. But again, he's going to understand that where it's unfair, we need to take some action. Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary confirmed, is on the job, was recently over in Germany talking to the G20, wouldn't sign a document that said we're not anti-protectionist, or we are anti-protectionist, that's what it was. It was a little bit of a controversy, but I think it's a bit of a tempest in a teapot. You know, he was new from all of the reporting that I read, most of the other representatives at the G20, were like, well, listen, he's new. He's still trying to figure out exactly what the policy is. We're going to give him a bye. There's another meeting in the summer, and we'll really figure it out when that meeting happens this summer. And I think it's really important to remember that kind of a fact. This trade team, a lot of these trade players, they're still either in the confirmation process or have been on the job for a minute. They're still figuring out what their team is. We talked to one of the president's special advisors on trade last week. He'd been in his job 2 weeks. So this is still a very new team. I think they're still figuring it out. One of the messages we got from the White House is that the trade policy is evolving, and it has evolved way past what the rhetoric was on the campaign trail. We are in the process right now, and hopefully everybody will see this sometime next week. We've drafted a letter. And our goal is to have companies sign onto this letter. It's a letter to the president that basically says, listen, we've got folks on both sides of this fence. We've got exporters that export 30, 40, 50% of their product to China, and we need to protect that market. We've also got producers here in the U.S. that face unfair subsidies from China. Trade policy cannot be one size fits all. So I hope Linda's going to set it out to all of you, and I hope that you'll consider adding your company name to that letter, because what I'd really like is a really good representation from the hardwood industry that this is an important issue to us, and we need to work on it carefully, and we need to work on it together. So that should be coming in the next week. The other thing to keep your eye on is tax reform discussions, because one of the things that has been talked about in tax reform is a border adjustment tax, which would basically shift the taxes from production to consumption. And just really, really simply, it would be a 20% subsidy on exports. So if you're exporting, you get a 20% subsidy. If you're importing, there's a 20% tax on those imports. Who knows what's going to happen with this, but it's an interesting concept. And a lot of the world uses this or some version of this when working on their tax policy. We're, I think, one of three countries that doesn't. So this is going to be very controversial. It's going to be tough to get through. But it's also another way to look at exports and imports and how they can be treated by the administration. So it's not just NAFTA, it's not just TPP, it's not just bilateral trade agreements. It could also be our trade policy that has an impact on how we export and how we import. This is kind of why we're in the middle and how kind of the two sides who don't, they're not fighting amongst themselves. We had a big discussion about this at the recent Hardwood Federation board meeting. We had kind of, we had the veneer and the engineered flooring guys at the meeting, and we had the exporters at the meeting, and everybody wants to do right by the other person. So it was a good discussion, but clearly there are issues here. 40% of all hardwood lumber is exported. 8.3 billion board feet were produced in 2016. 40% of that was exported. 60% of the high grade was exported. And we actually have a trade surplus in exported hardwood of 1.3 billion, which is pretty good news. On the import side, the Chinese hardwood imports have increased 35 to 40% in the last few years. And since 2013, imports have increased by $300 million. And the U.S. imports $1.1 billion from China in 2015, and it's about 50% of the market. So you can see there are two kinds of things that we have to balance here, and we're working really hard to do that. So with that, I'd just like to say in conclusion, thank you all for your support. It's really important to us. We are so appreciative of it. We're appreciative of Linda and of the HMA board, who always welcome me here and also are incredibly open when we come to them with ideas and ask them for support. Again, I'll be here collecting PAC contributions, which, just as a reminder, are personal contributions on a personal check. I'll also be collecting corporate donations to our funding for just kind of our operations, and those can be company donations, and they are 83% tax deductible. So think about it. If you have questions, I'll be here tonight. I'll be here the rest of the afternoon. And thank you again. And do I have time for questions? Anybody have questions? Jim? I have not, and that's concerning to me. It's interesting because immigration is another issue that we've really never been involved with. And there's some folks here that have been in the room a lot longer than I have. I know Linda and Tom Inman are here. Mark Barford's here. We've never really touched this issue. But as I've gone around, I'm just kind of starting my winter-spring tour. More and more people are kind of talking to me in a corner in a cocktail party and saying, hey, we're really concerned about immigration. This is really something the Federation needs to take a look at. So, but to your point, we've heard, it's a lot of rhetoric and it's a lot of hard-line kind of talk. But I haven't heard much. They've been kind of subsumed with other issues, so it'll be interesting to see how they address it, because we're not the only industry that's concerned about it. Yeah, I think Sonny Perdue is the last cabinet official to be in front of a hearing. And I would think everybody, all of the cabinet secretaries and kind of the top appointees should be in place in the next couple months. This has taken a long time. It's taken a lot longer than it normally does.
Now they're talking about a lot of...
You know what he's focused on right now? He's focused on appointing where he doesn't need Senate confirmation. And a lot of the, most of the undersecretaries, if not all of them, require Senate confirmation. So I think what he's doing is he's kind of getting the secretaries in place, skipping a level, and then going underneath where he could just name people to get bodies in place, and then he'll go through the confirmation hearing. Now, some are being rolled through at a fairly slow pace. I think Treasury is getting pretty well staffed up. But it's taking a really long time. And I don't think, like, with USDA, there's a couple of undersecretaries that we would like to see put in place, and that's going to take a while. I don't know if they, that wasn't part of what I understood. It was, I can take a look to see what the exact text of the bill is. It might have been included because it was like medical. It was all medical testing, illnesses, and injuries. Yeah. Anybody else? Well, come and join us in Washington. As you can tell, there's lots to talk about. We'll brief you. We won't let you out there on your own. All right. All right. Thank you so much.